This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nagel. Glad to have you along on the Ideas Network. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri is back to talk about insects that you'll find in our state during the summertime. Hi, Phil. Glad to hear from you.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. And we'd like to know what bug questions our audience may have for you. Maybe you need help identifying an insect or dealing with a lingering ant infestation. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org, and you can send a photo if you need a bug ID, because that's very helpful, isn't it, Phil?
Yeah, it starts you in the right direction. That's probably the easiest way to put it.
Yep, exactly. So just why is it that we have so many insects around here in the summer? Is it just the warm weather?
Yeah, being cold-blooded, insects really don't function well below 40 degrees. And so their whole biology is set to take advantage of the summer. And to some degree, it's an honest evaluation that the warmer it is, the faster they do everything, because metabolically they're kind of sped up.
So does that mean that if we have a hot summer, the mosquitoes will be gone quicker?
Well, no, it really does.
Oh, really?
In the sense that, it's kind of like you bake a cake.
Yeah.
You know, the warmer the oven, the faster it happens, and it does to some degree. And when you really get extremes, above about 112 degrees for most insects is fatal. Now, they can find places to go, but they really don't have any mechanism to cool their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why, bed bugs, one of the ways of controlling them now is basically to cook them out of structures.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That's good to know. What about ants? I mean, I think most of us have had ants in our house. How do they even get in the first place?
Well, they're good at squeezing through little openings, and there are cases of ants that will nest indoors. From an entomological standpoint, we always want to know what the ant is, because it tells us where they're likely to nest, how many nests there are, what their food preference is. But when I would chat with people about ant control, when ants start showing up in January, it's a dead giveaway. They have to be indoors where it's warm.
Mm.
When they start showing up in March, it even lends that they might be in an outside wall that might have been cold in January, but it's starting to warm up. If it is purely a summertime thing, it usually relates to them finding some food in the house. And once they get in the habit of coming in, they'll continue to come in. Now, as far as control, it comes down to one of two things. Ants either have a sweet tooth and like sugar, or they like fats and protein. And so when you buy baits, the only mistake you can make is to not provide the right kind of bait. So sometimes I suggest to folks, if you're not sure, just put a little bit of honey and maybe a little cooking oil and a piece of wax paper, see what the ants prefer. And there are some species that would honestly take both, and then go buy an appropriate bait. And the advantage of the baits is that if you can get the ants to accept it, they will take it back to the nest, wherever that might be, and feed the rest of the colony. And if you get enough bait there, you will control the colony. Again, from an entomological standpoint, we usually say find the nest and treat it. Well, a lot of nests are hidden, and that's where the baits really shine, is that if you can get bait acceptance, it will control the ants.
So if we have ants that aren't necessarily causing us a problem, should we let them be, and what do they do then for our ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean, there are cases of certain ants, especially in prairies, that just their general activity, kind of like a natural rototiller, does a whole bunch of good things to the soil and to the plants around them. So ants do have a good part. Some ants are predators on various insects that we would define as pests. Other times, ants kind of get in the middle where, in the case of aphids, they often will protect the aphids because they're milking the honeydew that the aphids excrete. And anything that defends aphids is a little hard to say nice things about, but overall things come into kind of natural control. So, if the biggest problem we have is ants either, again, create a nuisance, or there are some cases where they create big mounds and other things that get in the way of lawnmowers. And there even are some cases where ants, because they don't like their nest to be shaded, some of these big, big mound nesting ants can kill plants around them. So there are some occasions where it is a problem in a garden, but that's not the norm.
Okay, great. Well, let's go to the phones, Phil. We've got a couple of people who have questions for you. First one up is Sierra in Madison. Hi, Sierra. What's your question?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I travel a lot through Madison, and this entire summer I have seen no butterflies except for numerous sightings of the small white butterfly. There were a couple of times where I might have seen a monarch, but I'm not sure. I'm not seeing any butterflies anywhere I've been in Madison. And also, there is a drastic decrease in the number of dragonflies. So I wanted to ask about that. Thank you for taking my call.
I'll agree with you. My wife and I went out on a walk, saw our first monarch about the 12th of May, so we were quite excited. And I didn't see another monarch until about a week ago. And other than the little white cabbage butterflies, it's been pretty sparse. And so I agree that at least locally, the swallowtails and some of the other things just don't seem to be out there. Now, things can recover quite quickly with the monarchs I've been seeing in the yard the last week. They seem to have interest in our butterfly weed, which hopefully they're laying eggs, which means we'll get a good summer hatch later on. As far as the dragonflies, I think what gets us in problems is that, a lot of the temporary and even semi-permanent ponds that I'm used to seeing are drying up because we're kind of on the dry side. I know, they say that we're at an unusually dry period as far as mid and long term. And so I think some of the habitats that we would normally have them breeding in have dried up, and then you don't get dragonflies. Not that I haven't seen any, but, in general, lower numbers. And that one I think I can equate just to the lack of small ponds and the like, which is what they need to breed because their immature stages are an aquatic insect.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you so much for that observation, Sierra. Let's go to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hello.
What's your question?
Well, it's about walking sticks. I live on 5 acres, and it's pretty heavily wooded. And about 7 years ago, I had, tons of them in the yard and on the chicken coop and stuff like that, and I haven't seen that many again in, like I said, almost 7 years.
Sure. You do get what you could probably define as outbreaks. I remember one in the Baraboo Hills, and this has got to be 20 years ago, where there were so many walking sticks in the woods that when they were laying their eggs, which drop out of the trees, it sounded like it was raining.
Oh, wow.
But that's not the norm. Now, when walking sticks get in that high of numbers, literally you can have plant defoliation, the point that the trees are losing their leaves in front of you. But that's not the norm. Usually the numbers are very low, and because they're so well camouflaged, people don't see them unless they're crawling on the screens or something else where they're kind of apparent. Normally, if I'd have to go looking for them, honestly, raspberry patches and the like out in the woods is not a bad place to start. But again, they're so well camouflaged, and usually their numbers are on the low side. So if you sent me out to find one today, I'm not so sure I'd be successful.
Okay. Well, thank you, John, for that call. And if you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 800-642-1123, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we did get a few emails. And Phil, did you get the picture of the little gray insect from Ryder near Blue Mounds?
Sure. And the question was it a tick? And, if you look at the picture, what's interesting, now ticks have 8 legs, and true insects have 6. But this happens to be a type of weevil, which is in the beetle family. And because the antennae are so long, your first indication would be maybe it does have 8 legs like a tick is supposed to have. But this is a type of weevil. We have numerous species. Weevils are technically snout beetles because their head is usually elongated to some degree or another. And many of the species are not capable of flying because their wings are almost cemented together, or the wing covers, and they're kind of built like little tanks. And so you do see these. They move slowly. Again, they don't fly like you might expect an insect to. So it was not unusual for me in the lab to see people send samples of this kind of critter, wondering if it is some kind of odd tick.
Okay. Well, thank you for sending that in, Ryder. John in Janesville called but couldn't stay with us, and he has a prairie planting around his home, and usually there are Japanese beetles that destroy some of his plants, but this year there are none. Well, lucky for you, John. He wants to know, why is that the case?
Well, you know, I go to my own 20-plus year experience with Japanese beetles. And in the early 2000s, in my neighborhood, it was like a science fiction movie. I mean, there were so many beetles, all the birch trees were stripped, all the linden trees were stripped, all the grapevines were stripped. And it was about 4 or 5 years of bad activity. And then things started to get better considerably. And you know, there was even some data that the population at one time was only 5% of what it was at its peak. Well, I would argue it's even much lower than that, because in my neighborhood, when I'm out there, I think I have seen 5 Japanese beetles, and they have been active for about the last 3 to 4 weeks. That being said, you know, in Janesville, again, there's some pockets in Janesville that have had them as long, if not longer. In fact, the first heavy infestation I remember was down in Rock County. But my sister lives about 6 miles from me, and she sent me a picture of a critter that was both bothering all their plants and her, and lo and behold, it's Japanese beetle. You know, in her neighborhood, it is more of a newer problem, so things have not settled down. But the long-term encouragement I try to give people is, again, my experience is that given time, the populations come under more of a natural control. The sad news is if they've just started to show up in your neighborhood the last 3 or 4 years, it might be 10 years before you really start to see a significant decrease.
Yeah, definitely. I think we've talked about that before. Not fun when they invade your garden, for sure. George sent us an email, and he wants to know, or he says there are studies that show that the Japanese beetle traps just bring more beetles to your property and that make more of a problem than you originally had. And he's wondering if that's true, and also how does milky spore work?
Okay, so the problem with the traps is that it's been shown that you don't catch all the beetles that come, and so you literally draw more beetles to your yard. Now, in the start of when infestations start, they use traps to figure out where the critters are, because they're really very efficient at catching them. So the traps do have their use. And I will say that, you know, I would talk to people. The problem most of us have is we don't have a big enough yard to draw them somewhere else. But if you own 20 acres out in the country, there might be some places you can place the traps far enough away from your yard to draw the beetles away and not experience the problem in your backyard. But that's not the norm. Now, milky spore disease is one of the natural diseases. It is a type of bacteria that literally it leaves spores that last for a very long time in the ground. If the Japanese beetle grubs feed on it, they become infected internally, and honestly, their blood turns milky, and that's where the name comes from. It's very efficient, but the thing to consider is if I knew that your yard was heavily infested with Japanese beetle grubs, milky spore disease is a good option. It's somewhat expensive, but it's a good option. But honestly, most of our yards, and even my own personal yard when we had all these beetles coming, my beetles are coming from the golf course two blocks down the road type of thing, and so it really wasn't anything I did to my yard didn't make a positive effect as far as the plant damage I got. And that's the frustration with Japanese beetle, is that they feed on an incredibly wide variety of plants. They're active for approximately 2 months during the year, and they can fly in from a mile or two down the road. And so you do not have control over things. So I've got nothing against milky spore disease, but I guess in most cases I find that people don't have access to where the real breeding site is. And, you know, when we get into the hot spots, we're finding 60 to 70 grubs per square yard, or excuse me, per square foot. Ugh. It's almost mind-boggling there can be that many insects there. But then, again, you can consider if this is the golf course 2 blocks away. And, you know, the example I used in my sister, well, lo and behold, she's about 2 blocks from a big golf course.
Ah.
And one of the reasons that golf courses are so good for breeding them is that our normal lawns, you know, at this time of the year, they kind of go drouthy and whatnot. It's not the best habitat. But, of course, golf courses are so well-maintained, it's always ideal conditions. And so that tends to get things going. And, you know, the general trend has been Japanese beetles continue to move in the central and in particularly in the northern part of the state. That's been the trend for the last 10 years, whereas the initial infestations were down in the southern third of the state.
Okay. Well, thank you for that question. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nadeau. Clara Neipert is our on-air producer today, and Trina LaSousa is our technical director. And we're talking about insects with regular guest Phil Pelletieri, an entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. And Phil, let's go back to the phones. They're all filled up. So let's go to Janet in Madison. Hi, Janet. What's your question?
Thanks, Jill. Phil, earlier when you were talking about ants and how some ants that come into your home are looking for sugar sources and others are looking for protein, fats, et cetera. So I've heard you say that before, but when I go to the store to buy ant traps, it's not clear to me. It doesn't say on the box, this is for ants that like sugar and this is for ants that like fat. What do you look for when you're buying the bait?
Well, you know, I would say one of the most common baits that people get, and it was interesting, I just read an article in the New York Times about, you know, some of the tests that they had done on ant traps, but there's a product that's been out there forever called Taro. And Taro, honestly, now has boric acid. Back when I started my career, believe it or not, they used arsenic as a bait, but they switched. And that generally is a sugar-based type of bait. Now, the interesting thing, again, going back to if you put a bait out and you don't see acceptance, that's when you look to potentially manipulate it. And what I used to suggest to folks is the liquid taro that you'd put out, you could just mix a little cooking oil with it. And all of a sudden, now you've got the kind of food that would attract the ants, and they would pick up the boric acid and take it back to the nest. When ant problems get real frustrating, honestly, it probably might be worth looking into getting some of the baits that you would probably have to order on the internet. It's not that they're not more toxic to people, but it's just the way some of these things are marketed. So there are, you know, various do-your-own pest controls and whatnot, which will sell you the same kind of baits that professional people use. And then, honestly, things are really much more delineated as far as for protein-feeding ants or for sugar-feeding ants. And so, yeah, look under the fine print as best you can. It might even be worth going on the internet and seeing what other background information the company provides to maybe give you a hint. But as I said, usually what I tend to find is you're more likely than not to see sugar-based baits. And as I said, those are the ones that you might have to manipulate a little bit. And again, some companies will make a bait for both sides. And when you get a particular bad ant problem, it isn't the toxicant they're using. It is to solve the riddle of what the ants like to feed on the best. And that's where the advantage of the professional pest control companies have is if they know what ant they're doing with. You know, they've got a particular bait that works for pavement ants. They have another bait that they would tend to use for carpenter ants. It gets a little tricky, though, only in the carpenter ant example. The baits tend to work pretty good in the spring. We get to this time of the year, and honestly, because their diet changes, the baits do not work as well. And there are other ways of dealing with ants, but as I said, the frustration would be is you got to know where they are, and if they're hiding under a rock, you aren't going to find that, and that means you won't be able to treat the nest directly. So as I said, do as much as you can, and if the baits aren't working, where it gets frustrating are these tamper-proof bait stations, because you can't really manipulate those very much, whereas, as I said, that the kind of liquid stuff that you'd put on a piece of paper or whatnot as an ant bait, at least it has the advantage that when you're done with it, you can take the paper and dispose of it so you don't have the stuff laying around. But also, as I said, you can manipulate it a little bit as far as the food source to make it more interesting to the ants.
Okay, thank you, Janet, for that question. Appreciate that. Let's go on to Turley and Sullivan. Hi, Turley, what's your question?
Hi, Phil. I have an infestation of earthworms, but they're not the typical ones. We pick them up, and they're so wild, they literally jump off your hand, and they're everywhere in my yard.
Yeah.
What can I do about that?
We know what those are, don't we, Phil?
Yeah. So this is that invasive jumping worm that has been plaguing us now, and I showed up in my neighborhood back probably about 8 or 9 years ago. This gets real ticklish because you cannot find anything that is legally registered for controlling earthworms. There are some things that do affect earthworm populations, but again, you can see the difficulty the company would have to regulate and get the approval of EPA because the potential non-target effects of some of these things. And so, boy, you know, I my experience with invasive critters is that they tend to be the most highest populations are the most problematic when they first get into an area. And so that's kind of what I have seen in my yard. I can still find some jumping worms. We have been blessed to the point that I don't think I've seen any plant damage, although my wife and I disagree on this subject a little bit as far as, you know, when I hear some of the research that's going on at the Arboretum and the DNR is doing, we know that worms in general can be quite a problem in natural environments, woodlots and whatnot, because of what they do to the soil. Even though, you know, most of us were taught that worms are good because there is a aeration and a positive thing, but these jumping worms take it to a different level. They affect the soil structure, they affect the amount of organic matter that's around, and so again, if we could find some way to reduce them. You know, I know people have used diatomaceous earth and other things, and I just haven't seen a lot of data to suggest they're very effective. I do know that golf courses have a couple products that are registered, but they're hard to get and very expensive, and I just don't think it's practical. So then you fall back onto, you know, hoping that the local bird populations and other things find them. And again, what I'm expecting to have happen is something is going to move in to help reduce the populations and probably disease, might be predators or parasites. We'll have to see, but.
Well, it'll be interesting. Sullivan is a ways away from Madison, so they're certainly spreading, aren't they?
Yeah, I know, you know, and I just, every time I hear the DNR folks that are watching, monitoring the worm populations, or again, some of my extension colleagues, some of the county agents are finding them popping up all over, and it's not unexpected, I guess. And as I said, it's really very dramatic when the populations get much like this person has experienced. And what you tend to see is that, you know, we put on a lot of bark mulch in our flower beds, and it honestly degrades much quicker. And when they really get rolling, it looks like coffee grounds. You know, that's all the worm waste that's on the surface. And as I said, you can see the soil structure changes. And that's, I think, where the concern is what happens to plants. It's you're creating an environment that they don't do as well in.
Right. Now, with the mulch, do you think it is better not to put mulch, wood mulch on? Would that deter the worms?
Well, you can say that you make somewhat less food available, but then you look at the benefits to the plants. I mean, I used to get in this same kind of dilemma that certain things you would do would be beneficial to cutworms and other potential pests for the garden. But as I said, when you start to see the moisture conservation and other things that go on when you mulch, you find it's hard to argue that in the long run, that's probably better for the plants. And, you know, unfortunately, it does help the worms out a little bit.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Trulie. We appreciate that question. Let's go next to Lori in Sparta. Hi, Lori. What can we help you with?
I have a mystery bug, to me anyway, probably not to your speaker. I wish I had looked at it more closely. It's probably not a half inch long, but it was fairly good size. But the thing that was unusual to me, it looked like it had two big eyes on the top of its head. I don't know. Mm-hmm. They probably were. But I picked it up by its backside, and it bobbed its head like crazy.
Okay, so the critter is called a click beetle, and this particular one is called the eyed click beetle because it has those spots that look like eyes on the back, but those are not functional eyes. And if you look it up on the Internet, I see a bunch of pictures. They're really very interesting critters. There's also a Native American tradition that when you find a click beetle, there will be an arrowhead nearby. It's interesting because I had a very, very nice conversation with a person from the Ho-Chunk tribe, came to the university because he had told me about this tradition. He had no idea what a click beetle looked like. And so we just took him up to the museum and let him look through. And to be darned, he went right to the click beetles and he was right on top of it. So, the eyed click beetle is by far one of the more dramatic. Most of the species are both somewhat smaller and don't have that big bright eye spots on it. But the grubs are found in decaying wood, you know, so we got a bunch of stumps around in most neighborhoods, and probably more nocturnal. And the name click beetle comes from the fact that they can literally snap between their thorax and their abdomen. And it's like you snap your fingers, and literally, if they're on the ground, they jump. It's a defensive mechanism. It really is quite interesting.
Huh, very interesting. I actually just looked up a picture of them, and those eyes are very, very noticeable. So if you see them, I think that's a pretty easy ID, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. Thanks, Lori. Appreciate that. Do you have a question for Phil? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And if you've got a picture of the little insect you would like us to ID, that would be very helpful for Phil. Let's go back to the phones. We have Brian in Appleton with a question. Hi, Brian.
Hi there. I just wanted to go back to the Japanese beetle. Are those the dark opalescent looking ones?
They have a dark greenish metallic both belly and legs, and also head. And then the wing covers I would describe as almost a medium tan, but not shiny. But overall, I mean, it almost looks like a little piece of jewelry. And again, if you have never seen them before, the first one looks attractive, but when they show up by the dozens, then they lose that appeal.
Yeah,
that's what I have, definitely. I've had them for the last 5 years on my, it started out on my grapevine, and then it spread to other stuff. And the last 3 years have been just crazy on the amount of them that show up. I guess I heard that gardenias, they were supposed to be attracted to those and it kills them, but I haven't had any luck with that yet.
Yeah, the only plant that I know that there's some truth to that is there is a component inside some geraniums, and it's certain varieties of geraniums that is toxic to them. But as far as relying that on an overall control, it doesn't work, unfortunately. And there's just too many of them is the problem. And as we were talking about before, the frustration is there is no magic you can do on your property that is going to make much of a difference. Some people will change what plants they've got. That to me is quite drastic. I understand the frustration. There is insect netting you can put on particular plants to give them protection during the worst of the season. It's interesting. Sometimes if you can stop the first wave, they go somewhere else. And the story I use, again, my own experience, is I had some potentillas in front of the house. When the Japanese beetles got going, I never saw a yellow flower. They were eating them off as quick as they could happen. So one year, when they first started showing up, and we know there's this relationship that when they get on the plant, they attract others. And so they literally do gang up. So I treated the one plant once, and I didn't have a problem the rest of the summer. Unfortunately, they moved to my neighbor's Cotone aster bush and did not leave that alone. But, you get these weird experiences sometimes, and again, from one year to the next, you can't always be 100% sure there's only going to attack a certain plant. They might find something else in the garden, and there's some things they don't touch. Linden trees in particular, some of the birch varieties are quite susceptible. Grapes, raspberries are on the top of the list. I find I have some azaleas around, and they honestly, they scar the leaves up a little bit when they're really bad, but they never really overran the plants. The unfortunate thing is after they feed on these leaves, we call it skeletonizing. It's just kind of a surface feeding, and the leaf will turn brown, and that's what catches your attention. The good news about that, it's cosmetic. The plants really don't suffer. They're feeding late enough in the year. They're not eating heavy enough that it's causing the plant any long-term health or growth problems. It doesn't look good, and I understand that for most people. So, as I said, you're into the point now. You might be at towards the peak of the population, and one would hope that things start to take a dive in the next year or two for you, and things get better. And as I said, I'm just blown away in the Madison area, at least in my neighborhood, how low the levels are now compared to what we experienced down there, in the past.
Mm-hmm. They all flew to Appleton, so sorry about that, Brian. We did have, speaking of which, Amy sent us an email, and she would like to request that we stop referring to the invasive chafer beetles that we are seeking to manage as they eat our plants as Japanese beetles. So is that the true name? She's really concerned because of, hate crimes against Asian Americans. And,
right. and that's a valid question. Mm-hmm. It is the original heritage of this thing is a small island in the Japanese archipelago. And that's where it comes from. And the Entomological Society has changed. I think most people are aware that gypsy moth is no longer an acceptable term. I think what they're using when they try to work through these things is, we talk about German yellow jacket because it's East European. Referring to a country, it is a little different than into particular ethnic groups, and that's part of the discussion they're trying to say. Is it something that we should be concerned about? It wouldn't be surprised to me, especially again with some of the concerns about Asian hate crimes and whatnot, the Entomological Society is discussing that. I'm just not involved with those discussions to know if there has been a petition to change the name, like it was for the spongy moth now.
Mm-hmm. So. Great. Thank you, Phil, for explaining that. And let's go to Stacy in Fargo, North Dakota. Mm-hmm. Hi, Stacy.
Thank you, Phil, for explaining that.
Stacy, are you with us?
North Dakota. Hi, Stacy.
Okay, I think Stacy's got her radio on, but she's not listening to her phone. I'm sorry, Stacy. Well, let's go to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John. You have a question about those beetles also.
Yes, I do. So my question is, when they first hit us, everybody in our neighborhood put out traps, and we trapped hundreds of thousands of them. Everybody was filling up bags in days, which, 20,000 beetles in a trap. And then somehow the knowledge became common knowledge that you don't want to put a trap out because you're going to attract them to your yard. And everybody stopped, so nobody traps them. So my question is, even though that may be partially true, you attract them, are we not doing net great good to trap hundreds of thousands of beetles by putting traps out? I mean, if I am pulling them from my neighbor's yard, I'm helping my neighbor. I mean, shouldn't common knowledge be that we should all put traps out?
So where there has been successful trapping is in parts of Colorado, especially small towns. And, so much of that state is dry that there isn't a lot of good habitat. Where the Japanese beetles are thriving are in urban irrigated areas. And honestly, those populations were small enough that they literally did trap them out. In fact, it's interesting. I just got back from Utah and was visiting my son, and I saw some Japanese beetle traps, and it caught my attention and looked. And it turns out that they've got a couple real small pockets in Utah, and now they're just using them to delineate the pockets and then treating some very localized areas. And again, Utah's kind of the same argument. It's so dry in most of the natural habitat that is not suitable. I think the concern in Wisconsin, there is so much good habitat that, no matter how much you trap, as I said, you really are not denting the overall population to the point that it's going to eliminate them. In a small localized condition, I can see traps in a certain place could lessen the pressure on your yard. But as an overall neighborhood thing, I think it just, as I said, it's too big. The numbers are too high. And as I said, if things start to go downhill, it's going to more because of this natural control kicking in, that especially what kills the grubs. That seems to be the most important thing. If you can kill the grubs as they're developing, that has the biggest effect on the population.
Okay. Thank you very much, John. Vivian in Green Bay has a question. Hi, Vivian. What can we help you with?
Well, I have a small city lot, and I have prairie plantings all around. Last Friday on NPR, Science Friday, there was a scientist who identified, I believe it was a virus that's transmitted among bees who visit coneflower and brown-eyed Susan, and I do have those in my yard, and apparently the bee does get a diarrhea reaction. I never heard that. I'd like to learn more.
Yeah, I had heard the same thing. In fact, my wife had seen, I think, heard the thing and forwarded some stuff to me. There's a whole bunch of naturally occurring viruses and bacteria and other problems that insects deal with. In fact, one of the things, if you look at what has been happening with our honeybee population, is that, you know, it has had a whole litany of problems, and that's why we've had the decline overall. So, you know, understanding that there is this relationship that comb flowers and whatnot seem to increase the amount of intestinal problems in certain bees is one thing. But again, I think in an overall ecological setting, you know, if you could magically get rid of all the comb flowers, it's not going to solve all the bees' problems by any means. And so, as I said, I think it's something to be at least be aware of. But I'm not planning to reduce the amount of comb flowers in our garden because I just don't think it's going to have that much of an impact on the bee populations. And then what also, I did not get into the specifics of that, when somebody says bee to me, there's like 400 species that could be. And I'm not aware if he was just talking about honeybees, just talking about bumblebees, or talking more generally. It would be quite unusual to have a intestinal parasite that is problematic across the whole board of all our native bees. You know, some should be susceptible, some should not. So they said, I think it's an interesting thing. It's again, one of these things as we dive in deeper, things get to be far more complex than they first appear to be. But as I said, I just haven't seen any data to suggest that this is a big enough issue that we should be eliminating those plants from our garden.
Okay, we're talking about insects with Phil Pelletieri. He's an entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. What questions are on your mind? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is Larry Mueller's show. I'm Jill Nadeau. On the show tomorrow at 11, we'll talk about barns and the history of their design in Wisconsin. And then at 11:45, we'll take a look at the downside of fast fashion. That's Tuesday starting at 11. I'm sorry, that's Thursday starting at 11 on the Ideas Network. I don't know what day it is, Paul or Phil. Let's go to Paul in Viroqua with a question. Hi, Paul.
Yes, I've got my fall raspberries. I noticed some top leaves curled, and I opened them up, and there was a caterpillar in there. The largest one I've seen has a black head, and the first section has a black spot on it, and then the first three pair of legs are black. And I've never seen this one before.
Well, you know, without seeing a picture, I'm guessing, but there's no question to me, it's probably a caterpillar that we would associate with growing up to be a moth. And, you know, raspberries, like apples, tend to be quite susceptible to insects, but I have never seen them overrun to the point. You know, so this whole idea of curling in a leaf is kind of a protective device to keep some of the parasites away. It's not 100% effective, but that isn't that unusual in insects. And again, I don't know if this is a true leaf roller, which is what we call some of these caterpillars and the like. But being in raspberries, I really would not be too concerned that as I said, whatever damage they caused is going to be more cosmetic and really not worth doing much about. And again, because this is not a kind of problem, if it was really something serious, you know, it would be something that a lot of people would experience on a regular basis. And I just don't see that in raspberries.
Okay, Paul, that's good news for you. Now, Phil, if someone sees something like that, is it best just to pick that leaf off and dispose of it, or should he just leave it there?
Sure. I think that would, you know, stop the problem right now. Nothing wrong with doing that. Other than, you know, if you look in the wider range, you could kind of say, well, you know, if this thing's got parasites in it, then I'm destroying the parasites too. But again, like so many of these things, there's such other things going out in the environment that those are going to have more of a control than what we do individually on one particular critter.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's go to Glenn in Middleton. Hi, Glenn.
Hello, Jill and Phil. This is Glenn, your favorite forest pathologist.
But I know Glenn, the forest pathologist.
Long time no speak, but I've got an interesting question. It's either entomologically related or maybe it's just a hallucination nightmare. But my son and his grandsons my son and my grandsons and his wife were camping, tent camping, and I believe they were up in Trempealeau County in a state park. And during the night, my son awoke to this intense pain on his hand, and lo and behold, there's this huge beetle that bit him and actually drew blood. Now, his hands are not that big, but he says this beetle was almost as long as a finger, so maybe 2.5 inches for him. Is that for real? What beetle could be crawling around to bite someone? I think he said it had horns, too.
Okay. What comes to mind, because we don't have that many that are that big. So there are some big ground beetles, and they're predators, and they tend to bite. But this even sounds bigger. I wonder if it's a stag beetle. And male stag beetles have very pronounced jaws, and it's not their nature to go around biting. But if you put your finger in front of one and get chomped on, I can see. And again, it's got little spines on it that could easily break the skin. So if I had to guess, I'm going towards a stag beetle of one sort or another, because we don't have that many hefty beetles in Wisconsin. It's not like the tropics. And so the numbers are limited. So if I had to search, I would look under stag beetles. And then I think the next one I would look under is some of the big caterpillar hunters and other carabid ground beetles that we run into, because as I said, their jaws are pronounced, and if they give you a pinch, it would get your attention.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks for the warning, Glenn. We've got Sarah, or Stacy rather, back from Fargo, North Dakota. Hi, Stacy. What's your question?
Okay, so when I'm from Fargo, but right now I'm visiting Wisconsin. But there's European earwigs that are coming in my apartment, and they're on the counter, they're in the bathroom, they're on the floor, they're on the my coffee table, and so I caught two of them and put them both in a container, and one of them ate the other, but there's one still alive, and I don't know where they come from, really. I don't even know how they got in the house.
So earwigs, they have been in Wisconsin now for, getting on 40 years. And they are normally active at night. They feed on plants, although they are kind of omnivorous. They feed on aphids and other things. So I'm not totally surprised one chewed on another. Coming indoors is a dead end for them. It's not a good environment. There's nothing to eat. But they don't know any better. And typically what happens is when the sun comes up, they're looking for shelter. And if I had to guess, they're either squeezing in around fittings that go out, like a hose or whatnot. If that's not caulked into the siding, there's a crack there and they can come in. The other weakness of a lot of structures is where the siding meets the foundation. Things can squeeze up in there and then eventually go in. If they were going to accumulate, I expect them to come in the highest numbers where there is moisture, because they do like moisture. So, under the sink, in the bathroom is a problem. Because they can't breed indoors, there really is no reason to do anything inside. And again, the option when they're a problem is to get things sealed up in a way that they can't squeeze in. That's the good or the long-term solution and the most permanent. If that doesn't work, what is done is they spray along the outside foundation to basically reduce the numbers. It also is affected a little bit by the plantings around the house. The more lush and stuff you have next to the foundation, the happier they are. The drier that environment is, the less that they're drawn into the house. But again, in the apartment, it still would be worth looking at windows and making sure everything's fitting there. But I would look more at the weakness on the outside rather than, there's nothing that you've got that's attracting them other than, again, they're looking for a shaded, cool place when the sun comes up, and that's when they're squeezing in.
Okay, thank you, Stacy. We've got quite a few emails, Phil, so with some IDs. The first one I'm looking at here is from John in Green Lake. He said while he was outside making a birdhouse, he noticed that there was a black ladybug, and he's never seen one before. Did you get that picture?
Yes, I did. And so this is one of the more common species of lady beetles. In the typical color would be a very dark orange, although I have seen them almost tan. And there are occasionally varieties that are black. It's all the same species. It's just kind of a color variant. And it is quite unusual. I don't think I've ever seen this species, a specimen that's that dark. But I'll go back to, you know, the most infamous lady beetle in the state, this multicolored Asian lady beetle that invades our structures. You know, again, it varies on the number of dots it has, and from a dark orange to a light orange to almost white. But there is a black version with two red dots, and it's the same critter, which to me is really quite amazing. So you do see that variability in lady beetles.
Oh, I did not know that. I've seen the lighter tan color ones, but never a black one like that. That's pretty neat. Dick in Chippewa Falls sent us an email with an insect for you to ID, Phil. It's looks like some kind of a beetle with a big black spot on its head. Really
right.
Pretty.
This family of beetles are the longhorn wood borers. They're common firewood insects of one sort or another, usually in dead and dying trees. So people that bring firewood in the house sometimes find these in the middle of January because they come crawling out. This particular species, honestly, my first inclination, I don't recognize it as one of the more common ones, but there are some oddballs that show up. And so it's definitely what we'd call a longhorn wood borer or cerambycid. And I'll do a little digging. I'll get back to Dick as far as I'll give him a name for it. But I'm going to have to go to my references to figure out which species this is, because it doesn't strike me as one of the more common ones we have in the state. And there are probably about 70 species, I think, that we've recorded in the state over the time.
Wow, yeah, that's a lot to have memorized. So we'll give it to you, Phil. Dave in Finland, Minnesota, emailed us a picture, and he said that these bugs are on earthworm from his garden, but there are so many that they also eat germinating pea seeds, split carrots, and onion roots. Are they millipedes, and any control recommendations?
Yeah, so my first thing, you know, and it's, you know, if I had a more magnification, I'd be 100% confident, but I'm pretty confident. I think these are fungus gnat larvae. And fungus gnat larvae tend to feed on decaying matter once or another, so a dying earthworm would be a possibility. In the case of seeds, usually we argue that they're secondary, that the seed is rotting first, and as it starts to break down, then they come. And there are times that we do get explosions of fungus gnats of one sort or another, and there's more than one family of fungus gnats. So I think this is technically a type of maggot. But again, I think they're, if I had to define, because it's the nature of all that type, they're feeding on dead and dying tissue rather than being by themselves a problem. But you can get it, the surface overrun with them. In fact, you'll see pictures sometimes that some of these fungus gnats will line up in a line almost like a snake, and there'd be, you know, 150 larvae crawling in one direction. And it's really quite strange and like. But as I said, I just, because of their nature biologically, I'm not concerned about them being a problem, but that's what I think it is. It's fungus gnats.
Okay. And Dan in Appleton sent us a picture. He said he's seeing white specks, possibly aphids, on stems of his spirea plants. It's the first time he's ever seen them, and the plants don't seem too affected at this point, but what could they be, and should he treat them?
So what he's seeing are the skins of the aphids that were there. And, you know, when insects grow, they literally have to shed their skins. And so a couple things you can pick up from the picture, the leaves look a little sticky. Well, that's the honeydew the aphids left behind. And there's even a little bit of a dark cast to some of this. There's a mold that grows on that shiny honeydew that we call sooty mold. But what has happened is there was a very hefty aphid population a couple weeks ago, but they've crashed. You know, so you're seeing the signs of the aphids that were there, and in particular with the plants not showing any curling or other distortions of the growth, that also would suggest to me that their populations have declined, and no reason to do anything with it. And that's pretty typical of aphid populations in Wisconsin, is that they're capable of going through multiple generations, but usually they'll get a couple heavy populations, and then the parasites, predators, and everything shows up, and their populations crash. So it's not the norm. Where we get into bigger aphid populations is in greenhouses and other technically not natural environments, because then they don't have these kind of normal controls, and then the populations keep going and create all kinds of havoc. But in outdoor settings, more often than not, they said, given time, their populations will just take a nosedive, and that's what's happened here.
Do you think that's good advice for a lot of some of the damage insects can do to our plants? We tend to see it and kind of overreact. Should we just kind of wait it out?
Yeah, you know, I used to propose, you know, for serious gardeners to keep a little bit of a journal, because, you know, you sometimes forget what your experiences are. And, you know, what's helpful is to look at a plant and come back 3 or 4 days later and evaluate which direction things are going, you know. And it's true that a majority of what we do is for cosmetic reasons, especially with our ornamental plants. I mean, you can argue if something is eating your broccoli, it's a little bit more, or kale, it's a little bit more than cosmetic. And I can understand for plants for eating that we're a little bit more sensitive to it. But generally speaking, most of what's going on there is not really very serious. And as I said, if you kind of keep a little bit of a journal in some experiences. Now, there are some exceptions. One that I had noticed a couple, 3 weeks ago is there's a little critter called a rose slug that feeds on rose leaves. And again, it just feeds on the surface. When it's there, you don't notice it. 2 weeks later, all the leaves turn brown, and it just kind of knocks your socks
off.
Sure,
sure.
One of the good things is keep a calendar on that so you get it next year earlier.
Great advice, Phil. And we've got to take a quick break, but we'll be back after the news to talk more about insects with our guest, Phil Pelletieri. We're talking about insects on the Larry Mueller Show today. I'm Jill Nadeau. Phil Pelletieri is back with us. He is the former head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He's an entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus. Do you have any questions or comments about insects? Are you dealing with something you're not sure what you have? Send us a picture. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Now, Phil, before we go back to the emails and phones, we wanted to talk a little bit about spider mites. They can be kind of nasty. What do they look like, number one, and how can we control them?
So I always get concerned about spider mites when we don't get sufficient rains. You know, they are the number one pest of everything in California because of the climate. And here, you know, if we get normal rain patterns, they get washed off, plus the higher humidities, they breed slower. So it's when it gets dry that you get concerned about. And the trouble is they're so small, you're not aware of what's going on. When they eventually attack the leaves, it's like you took sandpaper to them. And they get this white stippling, which is kind of a little white spotting. And what happens is there's so much physical damage that the leaf will brown. And by the time you see that, you're well past stopping things. So I haven't seen a lot of spider mites, but the conditions are such that I just get nervous, mm-hmm. might be the best way to put it. So, you know, it doesn't hurt once in a while when you're watering the plants to not just water the root area, but to water the whole plant. And you can literally wash them off. To be honest, in some cases for houseplants, there's an insecticidal soap that's really quite effective. The only limitation, it doesn't control the eggs, and so you usually have to retreat about 10 days later. So it's just kind of a wait and see. In particular, the drier places in your garden would get hit first. Plants that are under overhangs tend to get hit quite a bit worse. In plants, again, in other protected environments. So it's just something for people to keep an eye on. If we get an inch of rain every week from now on, no worries.
Okay.
But if we get into a 3 or 4 week extended spell, the other interesting thing with spider mites is we often see an explosion when people take the plants from indoors, put them outside, no problem. But in the fall, when it starts to get cold and you get concerned about cold, you bring it back in, and 2 weeks later, you get a spider mite explosion. And so for that reason, it is not a bad idea to treat those outside plants before you bring them in and before things get out of hand. And, of course, what's happening when you bring them inside, aside from not getting the rain that they would outside, our homes start to dry out quite a bit, especially when the furnace comes on when it gets cold. And that's exactly the conditions that are conducive for bad spider mites.
Oh, that makes a whole lot of sense. Thanks for that info. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Rob in La Crosse who has an ID question. Go ahead, Rob.
Hey, Phil. Thanks for letting me rack your brain here on this years-old bug mystery. The bug was all brown. It was about maybe an inch and a half. It had kind of a snout similar to like a Cayman alligator. The body had, I believe, six legs, and the back was the alarming part. It had like a maybe a half-inch stinger-looking thing. And it, the only way I saw it, it kind of flew into my car window and landed on my lap. So that was what made it alarming. So
okay.
Yeah.
So I'm not 100% sure, other than I think the giveaway is what appears to be a stinger. That's got to be some kind of egg-laying device. And, you know, in that size range, there are some big sawflies and also some big wasp kind of critters that attack wood-boring beetles, and they use that long, you know, stinging-like device to insert their eggs into the wood tissue. So out of that group is my first thing. As I said, a log egg-laying device kind of eliminates a whole bunch of other things that would be in that size range. I don't know. I would look into wood beetle parasites, you know, do a search on something like that to see if it brings something up. But that's the direction I'm going with it. Even a critter called an elm sawfly, but I don't remember the ovipositor or the egg-laying device on that being big enough to catch your attention.
Okay, well, that must have been interesting, Rob. Did you scream?
Oh, yeah.
I would. All right, thank you. Let's go to Cheryl in Berlin. Hi, Cheryl.
We've lived in our house for 13 years, and this summer we have these strange, they're like yellow circles, mostly oval, and a little grass in the middle. And I was wondering what is causing that, because I don't see any insects.
Now, this is your lawn grass?
Yes.
I would go more towards the disease problem. But, diagnosing diseases is not easy on grass. Literally, you have to usually send a sample in. You know, there is a plant disease diagnostic lab at the university here that would run a sample. They will charge you for that, of trying to identify. In fact, one of them literally is called frog eye because it gives that green in the middle and circle on the outside. So that's one possibility. And it'd be worth looking that up on the Internet just to see if it matches. But as I said, there are other diseases. I don't know any insect that would give you quite that pattern.
Cheryl,
I'm leaning towards disease.
Mm-hmm. And we'll hopefully have Brian Huddleston on soon, so he can maybe address that on the air, too. So thanks, Cheryl. We also have an email from Audrey, and she's wondering, what can a homeowner do to reduce the amount of deer flies in their yard? Oh, they're nasty, aren't they?
Oh, boy. And that one. So, again, we're dealing with a critter that is not breeding on a yard. Deer fly maggots are found out in marshes and other wetland areas, but the adults can patrol a good distance away. The only thing I'm aware of, and I'm not even sure it's still on the market, but there was a deer fly trap that was developed, honestly, by a retired engineer in Wisconsin. He used to work up at, I think, Mercury Marine. And this trap comes from a design that USDA used. And his wife had horses, and she had the problem when the deer flies would come, they would scare her horses, and what can we do? So he looked into this, and he basically started marketing this horse fly trap. And honestly, it's a big dark ball that's hanging from a tripod, and then on the top of it, it's wrapped in a way that it's almost like a funnel. And what happens is the deer flies are attracted to that big moving object. They fly upwards and they're caught in a container up on the top. And so this is a passive way. And his experience of putting a trap or two out is that it reduced the deer fly numbers considerably. Because, again, it's kind of like attracting them, and it's very specific to deer flies, so you're not catching other kinds of critters. And I can see if the only thing that would be required is you'd have to have an area that you could put the trap out that it can be seen. If you put it in the middle of a wooded area, it's not going to work. Where it is on the edge of the woods, where, again, the light can shine on the ball and the wind can blow the ball and move it a little bit, that would draw it in. So that would be worth looking into.
Okay.
To be honest, you could, you know, again, from the plant, from the design, you could probably make a trap yourself. It's not that they're anything, you know, once you understand the mechanism of how they work. The other thing I have seen, and this is more for individuals, is there is a company that used to sell a little double-sided tape that you put on your hat for the reason that when you're walking, the deer flies come and they get caught. And the other interesting thing is deer flies like shiny. As many people probably experience when you're swimming and you come out and you're in a wet, that is the most attractive thing
yes.
to them. And that's why you often get zapped, mm-hmm. that type of thing. And so these deer fly traps for your hat was the way of least reducing the numbers because, again, they're so hard to swat. But, again, for a yard, I would look into one of these deer fly traps that are sold or, again, make one myself and just see how it works.
Okay. Well, excellent. I kind of get shivers just thinking about getting bit by a deer fly. They're nasty. Let's go to Ruth in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Ruth. How can we help you?
Hi. Yes, I had little tiny butterflies on my plants, and they were, the plants were had stalks with magenta color flowers or pink or bluish pink, and they had they were about as big as my thumbnail. And they had kind of an orange tone with a dark, dark edge on the wings when they laid flat, which I got one bad picture of.
Any idea okay. what those could be, Phil?
The first place I would look to are skippers. Skippers are kind of an interesting subgroup of butterflies. They're kind of in between a butterfly and a moth. And we do have some species that would fit that description. And so I would look to skippers first. The other butterflies I can think of that are getting that small usually have much more black dotting and other kind of patterns in their wings. But her description, I would look in. And there's a number of different species of skippers. It's hard to say which one, but that's the direction I would go. And, they do feed on nectar of flowers, so that's not surprising that you could see them. And, some species are associated with prairies. They're more of a grassland kind of critter than a wood kind of critter, so...
Okay, thank you, Ruth. Next up is Mark in Martin. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I was wondering if that big bug that bit that gentleman's hand could have been a giant water beetle, except he said it had, like, horns. And
the other one, although, it would not have drawn blood but would give you one heck of a bite, is the giant water bug, which is not a true beetle. And it's got a beak, and its bite feels like quite a sting. And so when Dr. Stanos had said his son got bit, as I said, I'm thinking something that had, the predaceous diving beetles, which is gets to be about 2 inches long, have jaws that are developed to be a predator. And that's what I'm thinking. It's something that is normally a predator-type insect that is not normally a blood-feeding kind of critter because we don't have that kind of stuff here. But in the wrong situation, you can get zapped by many of these predators. And again, the horn part, that's why I was going towards the stag beetles. We have horned scarab beetles here, but I don't know any of them that they have the kind of jaws that I would expect to draw blood. So.
Okay, thank you, Mark. Appreciate that. Let's go back to an email, an ID from Barbara. She sent us a picture of a moth. It's a white moth with black legs and some black speckling on it.
Right.
If you
look behind the moth, this is an egg mass that it's laying.
Oh, yes.
This is what we now would call a female spongy moth. It was what it used to be referred to as the gypsy moth, and they are flightless. And this egg mass that she is laying is going to spend the whole winter and hatch next spring. And so this is a sign that they have spongy moth in their area. And you can scrape the egg mass off and destroy it. What my concern would be is if I had an oak tree and I had 50 of these egg masses around it, it tells me that we're going to be having problems next spring. And, this is a critter that's come under pretty good natural control if we have wet springs. There is a fungus disease that's very tough on them if we have a wet spring. But as you know, the last couple of springs have been dry, and for that reason, their populations are up. Nothing in my neighborhood, but I had to only drive about 6 blocks away, and there are 3 giant oak trees that are 100% defoliated.
Oh, my gosh.
From these critters. So there have been little pockets that have been problematic. And as I said, the concern is more down the road, is this going to get worse? And it's going to be weather dependent.
Okay. Now, if someone sees them, what should they do with them?
Well, you can physically destroy them. I think what's more important than worrying about the adult flightless females is, again, these egg masses. And as I said, you scrape them off. There are some soybean oil sprays you can put on to take care of them also. The oil suffocates them. we are at a point now that this critter has been found in every part of the state. So, you know, it's not as if it's a new introduction type of thing. As I said, to me, it more, when I start seeing a lot of them, it catches my attention that we may be set up for a problem next May in particular, in early June, because that's when the caterpillars will do most of the damage.
Okay, good look for. Stuart sent us an email with a photo, and he's wondering if you could ID it. It's a caterpillar that completely strips all the foliage off of these perennial flowers. The picture is taken in the Token Creek area.
So it looks like a caterpillar, but it's not. This is from a group of critters we call sawflies. And although it might look pretty subtle, it's got too many legs to be a caterpillar. True caterpillars have three pairs of legs up on the front end, and then they have pairs on the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and tenth segments at most. Sawflies have legs on every segment. And another typical thing about sawflies is they come in herds. They often feed in colonies. And that's why you get the stripping like this. It's also quite characteristic of most sawflies is they're very particular about their diet. So they'll feed on one plant. And so normal garden insecticides are quite effective. Again, some of the insecticidal soaps would work. The only thing that doesn't work on them that is unfortunate, there's a bacterial insecticide that we use against caterpillars on our cabbage plants and whatnot. And people are drawn to it because it's really a natural type of and very selective control. This bacteria, because this is not a true caterpillar, doesn't work on sawflies at all. Now, this is one of those cases we were talking just before the break of keeping a garden catalog or calendar, because if I went out on the 15th of June and saw that there's a bunch of these things and they had really messed with one of my plants, I bet you next year, if you could step in the first week of July, a week or two earlier, you could catch them when they just get started. And again, whether you hand destroy them or spray them with insecticidal soap or, you know, with spinosad, which is an organic insecticide that's great for killing worms, all those would work. But there we would be able to intervene and make a difference. Whereas now, you know, we used to tease, but sometimes when we treat as revenge treatments, you know, it makes you feel good because you've stopped the insects, but they've already done their damage. And we know that treating this year, in this case, probably will not have that much of effect on what happens next year, whether you treat or not.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to Paul in Iron County. Hi, Paul. What's your question?
I raise organic kale on Sherwood Road in Madison. I think Phil knows where that is. And something's having at it like nobody's business. And they only eat the good stuff. The Lacinato and the Red Russian. They've left the Prism and the Dark Arbor completely alone. And first off, I'd like to know what's eating it and how can I prevent them from so doing?
Okay, so I might have to take a walk up the street to take a peek here. In fact, we walked by about an hour ago, and it didn't catch my attention. But does it remind you at all of the cabbage worms that you get typically? I mean, is it big chunks and little green worms, or does it seem kind of mysterious and you can't figure it out?
Yeah, it's kind of mysterious. All you see is the damage. I haven't seen anything in there except for those cabbage butterflies, and there are a lot of sparrows in there too. But I didn't think kale was in their diet.
No, I wouldn't think so. No, I'll have to take a walk up there and see. We've been having chipmunks and all kinds of crazy problems in the neighborhood eating things that they're not supposed to. But I don't. You know, it isn't unusual to find insects have preferences within varieties. You know, but you would think it would be more apparent. So as I said, I'll have to. Hopefully, you don't have a security camera that's going to catch me walking around in your garden. But I'll take a peek. I promise.
Oh, thank you, Paul. Obviously, those bugs are foodies that just like kale. It is Madison, right?
I'm sure there's some children out there that would wish there's more of those bugs attacking kale, but we won't go there.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind myself. So let's go back to emails. We got a picture sent from Patrick in Madison, and it looks like it's a milkweed plant with a couple of orangey red bugs on them, and he'd like an ID.
So... this is in the same family. We talked earlier about that beetle with the big long antennae.
Yeah.
This is a type of longhorned wood boring beetle, but it is of a subgroup that only feeds on milkweed. And one of the characteristics, they are red. There's three species of them, and you separate the species by the dots in the back. So it's a little bit like you get in here with lady beetles. And we would technically call this a longhorned milkweed beetle. Being one of the three species, its grubs feed on the plant itself below ground. Really don't seem to cause a lot of problems. The adults will feed. Sometimes the damage you would mistake for monarch caterpillars, but you don't find the caterpillars at home. You just find these beetles, and really not important, but they're milkweed specific. So you don't find them feeding on other plants. And, you know, the theory is they are brightly colored. They're advertising the birds that they are there because, of course, milkweed has plant components that make birds sick.
Right.
And so this is kind of a natural defense that they have of being so brightly colored, you know, about almost an inch long, you know, very attractive. They're great photographic subjects, I think, is a good way to think about them.
Definitely. Okay. And then Joe sent us an email with a picture, also for an ID. He said it's a bee that's digging a hole.
Okay, let me pull that one up.
Yeah, probably the last one that you got.
Ooh. Okay, I got to get this one blown up. It looks like it's a cicada killer. I'm not 100%. I can't, no, maybe not. What I'm looking at is the constriction between where the wings and legs are and the like. It could be a cricket hunter. So it is in the wasp group, and it's just particular what the species is what their prey is. And cicada killers, as the name implies, would sting a cicada and bury it in this hole and let its grubs develop. In the case of the cricket hunters, it's, as the name implies, they tend to feed on crickets. But the thing is that these are technically what you would define as a solitary nest, meaning one individual digs the hole, does its thing, but it's not the kind of nest that you think of ground wasps and the like, where there's hundreds of critters. Things that live in colonies and live in the ground are very defensive, and you've got to be careful. These kind of critters are very docile. And again, the more I look at it, I'm going towards the cricket hunter part of it. But we are at that time of the year that the cicada killers are starting to be active, too. So in either case, both cases are looking for sand or open ground to put their holes in the ground. And you might even sometimes find three or four of them work in the same area. And that gives you the false impression that there is, quote, a nest. But these are just individuals going about digging holes to lay their prey in, and then their grubs develop on their own.
Okay. And let's go to Matthew in Blue Mounds. Matthew, we have about a minute, so if you could make a short question, that would be great.
All right. It may not be able to be a short question, but I'm always wondering about the migration patterns of insects that come to an area that never had the vegetable, i.e. asparagus or potatoes before. How do they actually figure out to come there? Pheromones?
Okay.
Some of these, you know, just don't have the good flight.
Okay, all right, and sorry to cut you off there, Matthew, but go ahead,
honestly,
Phil.
Honestly, it's probably more random. It is true that insects can sometimes sense plants. That's how the cabbage worm finds a broccoli plant type of thing. But, sometimes you're blessed. You never have Colorado potato beetles, but once one finds your potato patch, it isn't going away. It's been my experience.
Yeah.
As I said, more often than not, it's more random. You think they just disperse in every which direction, and hopefully one of their offspring gets lucky.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, Phil, for that short answer. You did great. Phil's an entomologist and a Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus at UW-Madison. Join us again tomorrow. We're going to talk about barns and also the cost of cheap clothing. I'm Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay well.